Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are listening to Abraham Burton's Amina on this Friday, February 14th, a day when we remember and protest against violence against women and girls throughout the world. It's 1 billion rising, the anniversary of the first 1 Billion Rising, which was last year, and here we are again with another 1 Billion Rising, and we're going to be having some women on the show in the second part of the show, 8:30, to speak about this weekend's activities, 1 Billion Rising, this evening in Oakland at the Presbyterian Church on 27th, and I think it's like 27th and Broadway, it's like right there between Broadway and Harrison. And Regina Evans is going to have an encore performance of her wonderful piece at a program at the East Oakland Youth Development Center called Love Shouldn't Hurt. So stay tuned for all of that. We're going to have Larry Douglas on with Jorge Pinata. They have a show tonight at the 57th Street Gallery. And then we're going to close the show this morning with an interview with Nora, who has a wonderful piece, Miriam, currently opening the performances at the 10th Annual Black Choreographers Here and Now. And that's at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts this weekend, opened yesterday. It's really a beautiful piece. So stay tuned. Oh, and this first segment, I'm going to see if we can maybe get some other folks on the air. It's going to be a surprise, so we'll see if that happens. Oh, and don't forget, Margaret Avery is in here, in the flesh, tonight at the Castro Theater for a conversation and a program and a screening of Steven Spielberg's The Color Purple. Margaret Avery starred as, she's the Academy-nominated actress in the role of Suge in that particular film. So that's tonight as well. So a lot of stuff happening tonight. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so just remember, though, among other things that you'll be doing, that we need to rise up against violence against women and girls. That was Amina, and I wanted to give you some more information about another something else that's happening, because you know today is like Valentine's Day as well. And I wanted to let you know about a reading that a friend of mine, Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, is a part of, and it's happening this evening in Berkeley, or is it, I think it's Berkeley. Yeah. It's 8 to 10 p.m. It's a third annual Valentine's Day reading, Pandemonium Press. And Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, Sharon Coleman, Robert, I don't know how to pronounce Robert's last name, P-E-S-I-C-H, and Anthony Pino, with Gerardo Omar Marin on flute. That should be really nice. They're going to be performing at the Folk and Fine Art Gallery, 1861A, Solano Avenue. It's the cross street is the Alameda, it's the west side of the Oaks Theater in Berkeley, California. And so that should be fun. Yeah, and there's going to be some art there, too, an art opening of the 1920s. So it should be sweet. So that's this evening as well, among other things. So I'm going to just play a little bit. Oh, I wanted to let you know about something else. Tanya Santiago's is opening with her piece in its entirety. So that should be really fantastic. We weren't able to get her on the air. The Aguas Dance Company is presenting Movendo com Capoeira, and that's going to be simply fantastic. And that's at the ODC Theater, and that's this weekend, tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. So you definitely don't want to miss that. So I'm going to just play a bit of the interview with Margaret Avery, who plays Suge in The Color Purple. Again, she's going to be at the Castro Theater tonight for a special reception, conversation. That's at 7:30, and if you just want to see the film, I think that starts around 8:30 or so. So here's a little bit of that interview, and you can hear it in its entirety if you tune in to the archives, and that was Wednesday. And also last Friday, I played this interview. So we've been giving it a lot of airtime because she is simply marvelous. And now you can catch her as the mother, Helen Patterson, on Being Mary Jane. And that's really that's a wonderful sitcom that sort of looks at black life and all of its different manifestations through this particular family and a successful woman, Mary Jane, who is sort of like, you know, carrying us through her various exploits and trying to, you know, juggle career and romance. And, yeah, it's on BET. So, you know, they're not paying me for this advertisement, but, hey, Margaret Avery's on going to be, you know, she's on the air, so we want to plug her so you can catch this show. She's a woman with a chronic illness. She's got lupus, you know, which is a illness of the immune system, and Avasha was talking about that at our poetry celebration, that lupus as well as MS, they are illnesses that are not necessarily they're from most likely caused from environmental pollutants. So yeah, so it's great that you know that this is being brought up in this particular character that Margaret portrays.
Thank you so much, Ms. Avery, for the interview. Congratulations on your role as Helen Patterson in Being Mary Jane. I'd like to begin our conversation with a look at V-Day, which is February 14th, and 1 Billion Rising, which was kicked off by Eve Ensler last year as a worldwide look at ending violence against women, which ties, I believe, directly into your, you know, the character people know you most by, Suge Avery in Spielberg's adaptation of Alice Walker's book for the screen, The Color Purple. And the example, your character in the film, Suge Avery, set for the character Celie, portrayed by Whoopi Goldberg,
Whoa, what a mouthful, right?
So what is the question?
The question is, I want you to talk about, Valentine's Day, not as a day that you necessarily, expect chocolates, and cards.
Well, not at my weight. I can't expect chocolates anymore. My metabolism is minus 10, I'm sure. But do you know the history of Valentine's Day? Because I'm not sure. When I was teaching first grade, I knew all these holidays, but it escapes me now. But usually we just talk about it as our loved ones, showing appreciation of one another and romance. And but love can be expressed to many others. I mean, it could be expressed by making a donation to KCET or just to some foundation. But I think it's like a part of it means giving of oneself and showing appreciation of others or another.
Yeah. Do you know of E. Vinsler's call for addressing violence against women on Valentine's Day? She calls it V-Day, and then last year she called for 1 billion girls and women around the world to rise up against and bring attention to the violence against women, which unfortunately the numbers are not going down. They're actually going up.
Yeah, and you find that I think that any time the economy is really bad, you're going to find that people are more stressed and maybe even resorting more to alcohol to ease the pain. Our men, so many are coming out who have been incarcerated, and they're coming out with no jobs and not really the support system that they need. And it's like you get mad at the world or your boss and you come home and you kick the dog. So a lot of it is, I think, frustration with people. And then it's also environment, how a person grew up. They express themselves physically as opposed to rationally. So, and we have that a lot in our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as far as the special V-Day for against violence, I think that could be emphasized more. I'm ashamed to say that I'm not really that familiar with it. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly an advocate against violence. And as a matter of fact, I have in the past counseled, because I have a master's in psychology.
Oh.
I've worked with battered women and children, and so I'm just amazed that Los Angeles here, I don't think, is really aware of that, of Valentine's Day being the V Day.
Oh wow! Oh, that is amazing. That you have a master's in psychology in that, so I believe so. You are you're a therapist as well.
Well, I used to be until I started getting back into the acting again. It's very difficult to run that kind of business, and then suddenly you get a film and say, oh, to your patients or clients, I'll call you, don't you call me. Or put that suicide on hold because, I can't deal with you right now. So I just had to stop it.
Wow, that's really interesting because...
But I have to say this, whenever young people say, what about, how do you survive in acting? I think that it's very rare that anyone has a career that's always visible from the time they begin till the time they end. I mean, there's always those lulls. There were always those times when I said, well, gee, I wonder what happened to so-and-so. I haven't seen her in a long time, or I haven't seen him in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a life, and you have to, for me, I always felt that I needed to have something other than just the business, because it fluctuates. When you look at the motion picture home, where actors and people in the motion picture industry can go for assisted living or full-time living or the nursing home. And that was in, kind of put in danger a while back financially, but it's pretty stable now.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that qualify for the home who are in the business are usually the cameramen and production people, not actors. And as it was explained to me, actors sometimes have like 10 years of a great heyday, and then they have a lull. But you have to qualify by having 20 years vested in the business. And most actors don't get 20 years. So when I found out that I had more than 30 years, I was like, whoa, hey, you know, this is, I can say that I'm very blessed. And the woman that I spoke to at the home regarding these requirements, she was just amazed. So after that, after I found out how I had qualified, overly qualified, I said, you know, I don't have to beat myself up anymore because I'm not working or feel guilty that I'm not out there doing things. I can do other things. And that's when I became interested in going back to school. And it was actually for personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just learn about why, you know, how my growing up has affected my life. Why was I attracted to the wrong men? And I grew up in an alcoholic home.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets back to what I was saying, how people, their childhood or their environment can influence how they deal with others, conflict resolution. And the growing up in an alcoholic home, I saw that myself. My mother was very violent in her relationships because that's what she grew up doing as a child. She was the oldest of 13, and she protected her brother. She would fight for him, and in some environments, if you don't fight and stand up to a bully, you're always going to be picked on. So you learn to kick behind and ask questions later. And that carries over. That's got to carry over into your relationship. So I found out a lot of things about myself, and it just made me such a better person. My guy that I'm with now, my God, we've been together 18 years, and I never would have been attracted to him had I not found out about myself and made changes with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this interesting?
Yes, very interesting.
And I mean, people say, "Oh my God, you know, why can't I find a man?" Or why do? If you look at a lot of times, I found out it was like 20 years between a relationship that I had with my between my daughter's father, and then another relationship 20 years later. Well, it turned out they were the same men. It was the same kind of choice. They were both had some kind of, and they were abusive to me mentally, not physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, I started to think, well, somebody put a gun to my head to make me choose these two individuals. It's me. There's something about me. I have to change. And like I said, when I went back to school, that's why I say God is so good. I never knew that it would be a school for psychology. It was just, like I said, I just wanted to study something different, just be able to have a conversation other than about the film industry, make myself a little bit more knowledgeable about the world and others. And it turned out to be psychology, and I learned all of this stuff about myself. How you deal with life if you're an only child, how you deal with life if you're in a family, you're the middle child, or you're the oldest child, or the youngest child. There are different dynamics that carry over into your personality and into your adult life. And with me, the choices I made in growing up in an alcoholic home and in a somewhat violent home, that manifests itself into my personality in a relationship of not being able to communicate with my partner well, because I never talked about my feelings or my emotions when I grew up. It's like you just stuff everything. Well, in a relationship, you can't do that. You don't. You've got to be able to talk about things, and you've got to be able to talk about them before you're ready to just blow up, because then you're like pointing the finger and blaming and cursing and calling a person names. I'm talking about what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, words are so hurtful. And why do we do that? Why was I doing that? Because I was hurt, and I'm lashing back. But I'm lashing back because I waited too long to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
and let it just build and build and build. So, but anyway, we can talk about something else. The audience is going to say, my God, you know, Jesus.
Yeah, it's just interesting. As I was listening to you, I just saw, you know, some of your characters. you know, I saw this, you know, these various personas. You know, Miss Avery. You know, Miss Avery, the person. You know, being externalized in these various characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and that's what acting is.
Mm-hmm.
You do bring
mm-hmm.
what's on the page to life, and I think you can't help but bring a part of yourself that you can identify with or relate to,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time of not be afraid to show your vulnerability.
Right. Yeah. yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what's bringing you to San Francisco on February 14th, which is just a week from now almost, a little bit more than a week, and you're going to be at a special Valentine's Day celebration of The Color Purple, and you are the, you know, sort of the star attraction.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, Color Purple is a star attraction, I would imagine, and it's at the...
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yes, at the Castro Theater, yes.
The Castro Theater.
7:30.
Oh, that brings
mm-hmm.
back so much memories from
mm-hmm.
me being, having gone to school at San Francisco State
mm-hmm.
During the Flower Children days, and
oh.
Castro Street was a big street in my memories.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, the event is going to be there, and once again, we're going to show The Color Purple. And I will be available for Q&A.
Yeah, that's going to be very nice.
The film itself is shown so much on television. I'm just hoping that people are still interested in seeing it. But then there are people who are like in their 30s that have never seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine? It was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, it was met with such controversy. I remember there were pickets like, don't go see the film, and, you know, Alice Walker's response to, you know, the community's response, African-American community's response to the film, and she hadn't known that it was going to be what it was. The book is not the film. And I certainly encourage people to read the book. However, the film is a real important document.
Well, I always say, Wanda, that the controversy, and it's kind of a complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start this way. You know, The Color Purple came out after Sounder, and I think it was like 6 or 7, maybe even 8 years. Remember Sounder?
Mm-hmm,
with the lovely... Paul Winfield and come on, help me. She's on Broadway now doing the film. I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, that film was so uplifting to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And now, 6, 7 years later, here comes Color Purple, projecting men as being mean and evil. And so I always say that when you have just one film, people kind of want it to represent them. And this was not a documentary. This was taken from Alice Walker's book.
Mm-hmm.
Most people didn't read her book, even though it was a bestseller for a very long time. And I understand that animosity about that. Why is a white man directing black people in a film? You know, well, number one, Steven Spielberg was the only person in Hollywood that could do the film. No one else wanted to do it, and he, because of his power, he could get it done. And it was Quincy Jones that took the film to him. Okay, so that's why the white man directed the film.
Mm-hmm.
Steven also gave it the opportunity to a woman, Alice Walker, to write the film.
Mm-hmm.
But film writing, and she was the first one to admit that when she wrote the film script, it was horrible. It's a whole different artistry. So he got someone else to write it. And so the controversy with men, I'll go back to that, with black men, why are we projected this way? And I understand that now, because when I toured the film after it was released and I had the opportunity to tour it in Europe and Spain and, oh, the Scandinavian countries, and people were asking, are black men really like that? And I thought, oh, my God,
mm-hmm.
No. But what have they seen? What have they seen? Now, remember, we didn't have the Spike Lees and John Singleton and all these other directors, the Tyler Perry movies.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the only thing they had really seen. And so I can understand it being important to show positive images. And we still have that same issue in our culture, because people, black people, are upset that Halle Berry gets an Oscar for fornicating with a white man.
Yeah, Monsters Ball.
Ball. And then why is it that Denzel Washington, all the wonderful work he's done, mm-hmm. he gets the Oscar for being a thug and a... mm-hmm. What was that?
Yeah,
was
Training it? Day. Yeah, Training the police
Day.
Officer. Yeah.
And you start mm-hmm. to wonder, why is that? And now I hear people saying, oh, you know, why does Kerry Washington and Scandal have to be having affairs with the white man? And she was, I mean, I think, so, I haven't been following the storyline, but apparently there was a very attractive, handsome black man that she didn't have she broke up with, and they were upset about that, and it becomes a racial thing. It becomes very personal, and it's too bad, because as writers and actors, we're just projecting the story.
Mm-hmm.
We're not. It's really kind of hard to do everything in a story. But like I said, at the same time, I understand. Why is it? Why can't we get Oscars in a different light? You have to wonder.
Well, you know, you just think about sort of, you know, who controls the industry. And, you know, we can go back to looking at, you know, your, you know, nomination for the Academy and the politicking around that. And how you personally had to get involved in that particular work to even be nominated.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the studios don't support you, at least at that time. They don't support you in getting nominated. But
mm-hmm.
if you, as far as when I say support, you get the ads out and do those kind of things. But if you get nominated, then they rally behind you personally as the individual actors. Now, that's how it worked at that time. I can't say how it is today, but I would imagine it's pretty similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering, the actress that you were thinking about for Sounder.
Cicely Tyson.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I am still memorizing lines fans out there. But names, I see their faces, and I think, oh, my God, why, please, Margaret, say that name. Don't embarrass yourself. But Cicely Tyson, who was my idol for so many years, and I'll tell you a little story about that.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, in the late 60s, she came to a workshop. And it was on a Saturday, and I didn't have an agent. I hadn't done anything in acting, not on in film anyway. And in this workshop, there was a break. And I think it was at Lee Strasberg Studios. And it was a coffee break. And she was getting her coffee, and I looked at her, and I said, and she's just a teeny little thing, you know. And I said, you know, you have a mouth just like Cicely Tyson. And she looked at me and she says, I am Cicely Tyson. And I didn't know what to do. I was so embarrassed. I put my coffee down next to the coffee pot and I just walked away. So to this day, I try to be very gracious to people. If they come up to me and say, oh, you know, are you Suge Avery, whatever, because I know it takes a lot of courage sometimes to walk up to who you believe to be a celebrity and someone that you really idolize. And it's just, to me, it was just overwhelming for her to say, I am Suge Tyson. And I know my mouth just fell open and I walked away. I didn't know what to say. Oh, boy. We have to laugh at ourselves. Fans, we have to laugh at ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, it's a lot of responsibility being, you know, being a public person. You know, people recognize you. You can't hide when you go out.
They recognize me when I look my worst. I said, oh, God, I didn't put any makeup on. Yeah, I'm sure. Okay.
Yeah.
But
wow.
It's a blessing. I mean, for people to recognize me, they say they recognize me by my voice. As soon as I speak, they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because the film has aired so much. And some people have a copy of the film, and they play it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember I have a copy of the film and two copies of the book. And when the musical was making its way around the country, I went to see it, I think, three times. I took my classes. I teach at a community college. I took my classes to see it. We did a big group. And, and at that particular time, at the Black Theater here, Lorraine Hansberry, the union, Black Theater, we have a couple of others, but they're not union houses. They were doing a stage adaptation of Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really great, you know, having that juxtaposition of work, the Bluest Eye on stage and The Color Purple on stage as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, wow, looking at those two characters, looking at those, you know, looking at Celie coming up and then looking at this child, you know, growing up in this really abusive family.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, yeah, and how that warps your, you know, psychological sense of self. And so, you know, you create these other people to live in because you can't live in yourself. It's too painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to have seen that.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, that was Margaret Avery, and as I mentioned, she is going to be in town this evening at a special screening and conversation at the Castro Theater. But we are joined in the studio by a whole lot of wonderful, wonderful women to talk about 1 Billion Rising and to speak about how love just shouldn't hurt. So, gosh, a lot of feedback. So I'm just going to mention the names of a couple of our guests. And, all right, is someone online, too? Because I'm hearing, a lot of feedback.
Wanda, this is Tisha, and I've been here for 7 minutes.
Yeah, I know. I know. I was going to start with you, Louisa T.
But I don't know how we get rid of the echo.
But I don't know where
hearing.
The sound is coming from. Yeah.
It's probably from a cell phone, I would think.
Oh.
Maybe if everyone mutes, that it'll go away.
Okay. Let's see.
I'm not on a cell phone, so I don't know where that's coming from.
Okay. It's gone.
There you go.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Good.
Yeah, we definitely want to be able to hear each other. So I have in the studio Louisa Teach, who is going to be talking about 1 Billion Rising, which is happening tonight. And we're also joined in the studio by Mary Owens, who's one of the organizers for 1 Billion Rising. We have Cheryl Chambers. Cheryl, are you with us?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, and we have Vanessa Scott. Vanessa, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. And then Regina Y. Evans, poet, playwright, who's going to be doing an encore performance of 52 Letters tomorrow, sort of continuing this weekend of looking at violence against girls. Regina, are you with us?
I am here.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Did I call everybody's name?
No, you have one more, Regina Jackson.
Oh, Regina Jackson. Okay, Regina.
Good morning, Sue.
Good morning, Regina. I don't think I see your bio here. but thank you for joining us. So why don't we start with Yaya Teach, and maybe you could tell us, you and Mary, about 1 Billion Rising, sort of what is 1 Billion Rising?
1 Billion Rising is one of the most magnificent things that's going on the planet at this time. We often invoke for a global village that is a way for people all over the planet to be tuned in at one time, concentrating on a particular thing to magnify the power of our collective energy. And what is happening today and tonight is that all over the planet, people are gathering in buildings and taking to the street, dancing and singing and asking that there be justice, freedom, peace, and beauty as a measure against violence against women, children, and men all over the world. And so we are putting in what's called sweat equity toward this transformation. We are moving our bodies. We are raising our voices. We are bringing awareness, and we are planning to give gender violence a peaceful death.
Wonderful, wonderful. Mary, do you want to add something to that?
Well, first of all, yette abena to all of you. Louisa, you are always so beautifully eloquent that it's hard to come after you, but the only thing I would really add is that Louisa is absolutely right. We're a bunch of activists, writers, thinkers, rising up, demanding change, striking, dancing, rising in defiance of this injustice, what I call the all-out global assault on women. And I don't know if anyone's been noticing lately, but it's crazy with this assault on women. So we're rising up in defiance of this injustice that women suffer. And it's the next step, essentially. Last year we rose, but this year is the next step. It's rising for justice for the overall strategy to raise this, as Louisa so eloquently said, this global consciousness towards this lack of justice in our struggle that we must end violence against women and children. We're going a little further this year. We're going a little deeper to create really concrete actions to address the impunities and lack of accountabilities in this, with the laws and everything like that with that perpetuate violence against women. So everybody that you will see today, tonight, we are all keenly aware of this need to create and uphold laws and ensure judgments are made in court and ending this injustice once and for all. So I'm very excited to be with all of these wonderful women tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here in the East Bay, Bay Area Rising, in conjunction with V-Day, 1 Billion Rising Movement, announces Stand for Real Love, and that's at the First Presbyterian Church, 2619 Broadway in Oakland. And the doors are opening at 6:30, and the performance starts at 7. And there are fewer than 100 tickets left. But also another place...
We actually have sold out online, so come to the door and get your tickets, but come early.
Okay, all right. Yeah, and I know in the city of San Francisco, the whole city is sort of taking on an action against violence against women and girls, and they're going to be having some things happening at City Hall and letting women and girls and other people know sort of what kind of resources are available. How can people find out what's going on throughout the world? Is there a website or something people can, you know, check out?
V-Day, I'm sure Louisa and a lot of these women know, but I'll just tell you V-Day, if you go to vday.org, or also if you go to 1billionrising.org, those two places are great resources for everything that's going on globally. On 1billionrising.org, they'll be streaming live events from a lot of the places around the world. So if you go on to 1billionrising.org or V-Day.
It is so wonderful, the footage that's presently on from the last one. I have been sending it to people everywhere, and here's what's amazing about it. I am surprised by how many people know about it already. People who I thought didn't know about it and are doing it in small pockets around my extended community. And then the people who don't know about it, once I turn them on to that little video, it's like, it opens up a whole new world of connection for them. So I'm really, really grateful that we are able to connect with each other in the moment and then duplicate that energy through that video. It's an amazing organizing tool that touches people emotionally as well as intellectually, and motivates people to do something in their own area.
Mm-hmm. Right. Louisa Tease, you're a storyteller, writer of several volumes, Priestess of Oshun, the African Yoruba Goddess of Love, and you teach at many universities.
Don't worry about the bio, because it's about to change.
And then Mary Owen, you're in high tech management, and also besides, you know, working with Bay Area Rising, you're visiting the Navajo Nation several times a year and volunteering for many of the activities in the Adopt a Native Elder program. This program supports traditional elders. And then with regards to Regina, who you're calling us, I believe, from New York, you've got your wonderful play, 52 Letters, and you're joined in the studio by, some of your wonderful supporters. I was wondering if maybe everyone, you know, could just take a few moments. Regina, you could talk about your play and what's going on tomorrow around Love Doesn't Hurt, because this is a event that happens, I believe, annually here in the Bay Area, in Oakland specifically, and this time the event is happening at the East Oakland Youth Development Center. So why don't you tell us about that, and then we could have some of your supporters, Cheryl Chambers and Regina Jackson. Is that what you said?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, right, and then Vanessa Scott. Okay, so Regina wants to start. Mm-hmm.
Well, the event is, this is the first one. Is that right, Vanessa? Love Don't Hurt.
Yes, this is the first time we're doing doing this event in particular and with these partners, so we're really excited about that. Yeah.
Okay. And I was just actually pulled into it, so it's like a huge, it's amazing because it's just this huge community effort, and so it's not only my play, there's going to be an amazing panel with some amazing speakers on it. I was pulled into it to, you know, joining in with Regina Jackson from the, you know, East Oakland Youth Development Center, and Regina's been a stalwart in the community, like uplifting children for many, many years, and Vanessa Scott, who's founded an amazing organization, Love Never Fails, rescuing and women and kids, you know, from sex trafficking. And, I mean, her story is just amazing how she started the organization. And then Alpha Kappa Alpha joined in, which is also, of course, an amazing organization, which has worked up with women and the community for many, many years. So I'll be performing my play as a part of this huge event and a community, really community-based event. And my play is on sex trafficking. It won a Best of Fringe Award, and so it's just kind of going on. But basically it speaks to the stories of sex trafficked victims.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, well, Regina, since you are – oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm just Regina. Yeah, I'm just thankful to be a part of it, so –
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Regina Evans. Regina Jackson, since you are the director of EOYDC, why don't you talk about this Love Doesn't Hurt program and why you decided to host it there, Unite EOYDC. You all do some great programming. We've had you on, like, many years ago. and you actually gave the commencement at the college where I teach, College of Alameda, and that was really great, too. But, yeah, but talk about, you know, sort of the need for this type of program in Oakland, which has a really high, I mean, I don't know if we're still the highest, but it's very high numbers in sex and trafficking of children.
Absolutely, and thank you very much for hosting us, Wanda. In terms of the communities that are so, so very much in danger around sex trafficking, you need only drive down or walk down International Boulevard any day or evening, and you see a plethora of young women being trafficked, pimped out, the whole deal. In terms of our responsibility to community, EOYDC was so pleased when Wanda and Cheryl brought it to my attention that they wanted to put on something like this. It was something that I couldn't say no to, because anything that elevates and informs our young people and helps them to create confidence-building measures and toolkits for their own survival and exposes this atrocity is something that we want to support.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Other collaborators in Love Doesn't Hurt want to speak?
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead, Cheryl. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I guess
thanks.
The things that I was impressed about, the sorority Alpha Kappa Alpha had taken on the human trafficking issue and initiative as part of our global leadership through Timeless Service. And I went to a conference in Montreal and listened to several people who were involved in the international aspect of it. And so when I came back home, I began to do my research and discovered Love Never Fails and Vanessa Scott and the work that they're doing, where they're actually going out at night and talking to the individuals who are involved in this. And so I wanted to meet her. We had already, as our chapter, Psi Gamma Omega, had been doing some work at East Oakland Youth Development Center, and asked them, could we put on something like this in conjunction with trying to get awareness out to our community? Because in our chapter, you know, we were able to have Vanessa and Benita Hopkins, who takes this message and this education out to the Oakland Unified School District, come and get us up to date on what is really the face of human trafficking in our community, which is so prevalent, because we didn't understand it, and I didn't know that it was at such a young age, with girls as young as 12 being compromised. And so I was so pleased that Vanessa was able to agree to moderate our panel, who has Oakland city attorney Barbara Parker on there with several abolitionists and survivors of this type of violence. Regina's play was brought to us by a member who knows her, and we went to support her play in San Francisco, and she's going to do an encore performance. So it was almost a perfect storm of people who are involved in the community and the sorority, convening them together so that we can really get the word out to youth and some of our adults so that we know what this looks like and have some tactics on how to deal with it. So I couldn't be more pleased that we've been able to work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Vanessa?
Yeah, and I'll just pile on. So grateful to be able to work with these powerful women that really, really care about, safety of all people, right, in Oakland and otherwise. And this is one of the vehicles that we're going to be using to educate the Bay Area. We actually have people coming from the South Bay and people coming from Richmond and San Francisco to this event to learn more about how human trafficking is just eroding, at life, eroding at hope and really deteriorating young people in such a insidious way that, it's time for the community to rally. I heard my sisters earlier in the program also, talking along the same lines, rally around, the need to take a look at abuse, the need to take a look at, violence in the home, the need to take a look at poverty, all of the things that sort of contribute to a young lady who, by the way, the average age of a young lady who is being exploited in Oakland is 11. So we're talking about our babies being sold out there on International Boulevard, and what's so hard to stomach is that they're being sold and the community is immobilized in many ways because we just drive by because we don't know what to do. Even the police have their hands full and cannot address each person that's there and bring them to the services that are available. So they're just left there to be sold and to be abused. And it's kind of hard to hear, but we're talking about an 11-year-old who's being raped 8 to 9 times a day, 6 days, 7 days a week. That should not be happening in our country, and certainly not right in front of our faces. And so, myself and all of the women on this call, and the AKAs and all the people who work at EOYDC, and Regina is part of several theater groups. Our organization has 175 volunteers. We're a volunteer-led organization. We're all rallying around this and making it, we've made a decision that we can no longer pass these young people by. And by the way, we're very passionate about the young men as well. We believe that young men are pulled into being exploiters for the same reasons that young ladies are pulled into to be exploited. And yes, there are young boys that are exploited, but those are those are usually the minority. But many of our young men, our teenagers, are being recruited and groomed to exploit because they don't have other opportunities, and they're being lied to, and they're being maybe their child abuse. Actually, statistically speaking, 88% of those that exploit were abused as children. So their own issues have contributed to them thinking that it's okay to do what they're doing, and they need to know that there's hope and that there's some alternatives. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. And we have a couple young men on our panel that are going to be taking a stand against this issue and educating the community on what we can do to move ourselves in a better direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Vanessa, I wanted to mention that your organization is Love Never Fails Us, and it's loveneverfailsus.com, and you say in your bio that the services, you say that the issues of sexual trafficking will be solved with committed demonstration of love through prayer, mentoring, job training, outreach, and education. And these are all services that Love Never Fails provides. But what I was really drawn to in your bio was that, you work with young people in a youth dance team, and their ages like 3 to 25. But in 2010, mm-hmm. one of your 15-year-old students was sold into the Bay Area sex trafficking industry. Did you get
right.
Did you find her? Were you able to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I had been volunteering as a dance teacher on Friday nights for about 10 years, and she was 15 in 2010, and she was raped in Hayward and then sold throughout the Bay Area, and I looked for her and went up and down International Boulevard, and I became familiar with all the blades that are in the area, and for those that are on the call, just terminology, blade, track, that's a place where people are being sold, and I just couldn't believe that there were so many women, you know, and boys, and just, it was just horrible to see how many people were being sold, but after about a year, I was able to get in touch with her, find her, help her to get to some services with the help of some of my partners like Missy and West Coast Children's Clinic and Baywar. And so all of us kind of rallied around her and got her into some help. And she came out of a rehabilitation program after about a year. She's actually in our job training program now, and she's got a mentor. And it's actually quite miraculous because a woman that I am mentoring, who's a survivor. She's a grown woman about my age. She's a survivor, and I'm mentoring her. And I didn't really know at the time that this would happen this way, obviously, but she has connected with my student in such a strong way that actually she's, my student is actually moving in with her on Monday, and she is going to be adopting my student. So if you can believe the, you know, how amazing and miraculous this thing is, my student gone exposes me to, you know, sex trafficking and the problems of it. We get her back. We help her to get the services that she needs. She comes back into our program, starts interacting with some of our mentors, and then there's this love connection between she and again, it's Erica Thompson is our director of outreach on our team. They just connected in such a strong way, and now Erica and her husband Ken are taking steps to actually adopt my student as we speak.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to mention to our audience that we're speaking about the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Inc. in partnership with the East Oakland Youth Development Center, EOYDC, and Love Never Fails. They're presenting Love Don't Hurt, and that's featuring Regina Evans, 52 Letters, and there's going to be a panel discussion, Stop Bay Area Child Sex Trafficking, Moving from Discussion to Action, and then there's a reception afterwards. The program is from 3 to 6. And
3 to 5.
3 to 5. Okay, the reception is 5 to 6, I guess. And it's, the EOYDC is located at 8200 International Boulevard, and it's a free event. So everyone should come out. And I want to go back to, we're running over a little bit. I'm going to go over about 5 minutes. I want to go back to Louisa Tisch to Mary, I believe, and let you all, like, comment. And
well,
also,
you know,
announce
the,
again Bay Area Rising. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I'm wanting to put out here, listening to the conversation about what we're doing about sex trafficking. Years ago, the year that Hurricane Katrina struck, I had received a communication from a woman in London by the name of Wren, who had come upon a truckload of children who had been chained and brought in for sex trafficking, but the thing had been abandoned. And when they spoke to the children were told that they had been put through a ritual and that they were being trafficked like this because they were witches, and this was a spiritual debt that they needed to pay. And I was on my way to England to undo that thought, that energy pattern, when Hurricane Katrina struck and knocked down my mother's house, and I had to redirect my energy. But, you know, I want people to know that it is important for all of the spiritual and religious organizations to get involved in this and to make sure that our children know no matter whether you are Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, Buddhist, Yoruba, no matter what tradition you are in, there is no deity, there is no God who is endorsing this kind of behavior.
That's right.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, Mary?
I'm so moved by all of these women that are on this show today. Thank you, Wanda, for gathering everybody together. They do such wonderful things. I just want to share the last little bit that how much being involved has transformed me. I did my work on the reservation with Adopt a Native Elder, and working with my grandma out there near Chinle. And when I came across this, and I came across people like Louisa and Carolyn Hunt and Cecily and people like that, how much it transformed me to work for the betterment of women, the world, the global community. And I'm just very grateful, and I thank you for gathering us all together.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Anyone, Regina Jackson, Regina Evans, any parting comments?
My only parting comment is just I'm grateful for the community, and I think that's basically is what is going to, you know, make this thing fall over, this evil fall over. And so I'm just grateful for all the women that, you know, for Regina and the Cheryls and the Vanessas. And I just have to say Vanessa is just an extraordinary woman. She actually brings me to tears. So, you know, it's amazing to be able to work alongside of her. It feels like an honor. You know, just because I see her, I've been out on the streets with her, and she's like a warrior. I'm like, how do you do that? You know, and because it's scary, and she has no fear. And so the world is just a better place for people like these women. So I just want to say I'm grateful.
I have to echo Regina's comments. Partnership is just amazing in this scenario that, you know, there are no egos. We are all together to try and lift our young women who, you know, are the very best of us. They are our future. And to have an expert in the arena like Vanessa has really directed and guided us so much. And to look at the AKAs and their, you know, extra service hat, because this is not tutoring, you know, this is big time. So I just appreciate that this has all come together and that we have the leadership of Regina's play to really anchor this very difficult and necessary discussion to empower our kids and empower the community.
Right.
And Wanda, this is Cheryl. The last thing I'll say is
Cheryl.
We really need to take action. We can't just drive down the street and ignore it and walk away. We have to know what to do and do it. If somebody's being bullied, if somebody's being exploited, we need to have the courage, like Vanessa, Regina, and Regina Jackson, to step up and do something and not act like it's not our kids and it's not our community, because it is. And if we don't do anything, then it's just going to keep going on, and we just have to confront it. So I'm hoping that those of us who call ourselves middle class and comfortable get the information and start being aware that our kids as young as 11 are being exploited, and we've got to stop it, and it begins with us. And so Alpha Kappa Alpha is taking this on, and I appreciate all of our partners and you giving us this time, because it's been an awakening for me.
Wow. Thank you all so much. Oh, I hear someone.
I just wanted to say thank you. If I could just really quickly say thank you again to all of the ladies. I'm humbled. And I do want to say that one of the things that oftentimes overwhelms people is they say, well, I can't walk the streets, you know. I can't pull over when I see the girls being exploited there, and that's fine. You know, everybody is called to a different thing in this in this struggle here that we're having, and where it starts is for you to acknowledge that you're bothered, that you're not okay with just letting it slide. And there are things for all of us to do. You could mentor somebody who's at risk that's never been exploited. Just being there to cook a meal for a young person, or coming alongside a mom that has five kids that really doesn't want to neglect their children but has no alternatives. This whole model, I heard about some program in the Tri-Valley area that's called Rent a Grandma, and it made me laugh at first, but, I mean, you know, just imagine what it would be like if each of us would just go in and cook a meal for a family that we meet, offer a young person the opportunity to go to a basketball game or something like that, or maybe just go into the classroom for 1 hour and teach kids about abuse. Maybe that's your calling. But whatever it is, I just encourage you to kind of really think about it and what your unique talent is, and then bring it to bear, because there's nothing that we don't need at this point. And again, the ladies that are here, we've all come together with different skills, and it's just been wonderful. And in that same fashion, each of us that are listening today can do the same. So.
Thank you so much. Well, we're talking about 1 Billion Rising tonight at the First Presbyterian Church in Oakland. 6:30, is that the time?
Doors open at 6:30, and
right.
The performance starts at 7. And
okay,
it's going to be rocking.
It is. I was there last year. And Love Shouldn't Hurt is tomorrow from 3 to 5. At EOYDC, 82nd and International Boulevard, right in the nexus of where all of this is happening. Thank you all so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll be able to have this conversation sooner, like then, you know, a year from now, to see how things are going and how people can plug in.
Thank you.
Okay, Wanda.
Thank you all so much. Thank you to all of you for
the dedication to our future.
You're welcome. All right, peace and blessings, everyone.
Blessings.
Same to you.
You're
bye-bye.
Welcome. Bye. Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Jorge. How are both of you doing? Uh-oh. Let's see. I'm going to play, Oh, here we go. Now we can hear you. Thank you all for staying in the studio and hanging in there. How are both of you doing?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, we're doing great.
Oh,
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. So, see, Larry, saw you last week at the 57th Street Gallery, and you told us that you have a show. You and Jorge have a show this weekend. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I think it's going to be an exciting show, and I'm going to let it go at that. Maybe Jorge will add something to it. I'm excited.
Yeah, so am I. It's it's really great to be able to play the material that we've been working on, and I'm definitely excited about it also. And, we have great musicians with us. So I think it's going to be great. It's going to be like the beginning of a new year.
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually is the beginning of a new year. So tell our audience, Jorge, you are a musician, percussionist, arranger, and vocalist and composer. And you founded Latin Blood Sangre Latina in the early 70s, a poem with several local bands. And in 1976, you completed music studies at San Francisco State University. In 1977, you left the Bay Area to pursue a different career in chemistry and business, and then you came back nine years ago. Music scene. Yeah. So you're back. You've been back a while now, and you joined a local group as a vocalist and arranger, so you've just got this wide range of artistic expression. And then you started the Latin Jazz Project in San Francisco, and you currently are working on the Latin Jazz Septet, and you continue to compose and arrange. And then you and Larry Douglas, whom you play a variety of instruments, Larry, and you're you're with a tone that the Dean of American Jazz Critics, Leonard Feather, described as velvety and silky. You have ruled as one of San Francisco's top trumpet fugal horn players for more than 3 decades. I'm like, 30 years? Oh, my gosh. And I don't know, like, when Craig Harris wrote this. So it might be 40 years now. Who knows? I don't know if you're that old, but anyway.
Rhonda, you dated me.
Yeah,
you know?
And you play, you know, you led your own electroacoustic group, the Larry Douglas Altet, and you work with such stellar musicians as Freddie Hubbard, Chuck Berry, Albert Collins, Sun Ra, Rufus, and Carla Thomas, and you know, some of these folks are ancestors now, so they're living in you now, and they're living in your horn, literally. Like when you play, you're like, they're coming through. And you're a member of Johnny Otis and his orchestra, and your playing was featured on 4 albums, including the Grammy-nominated Spirit of the Black Territory Bands. And I met you as a part of the group with Idris Akamor.
No, Hanif and the Sound Voyages.
Oh, Hanif and the Sound Voyages. Oh, is that?
Yes,
oh, okay.
Hanif and the Sound
Voyages. Okay. Yeah. And we saw Hanif last week, and he's going to be featured at your concert, Nick, tomorrow, right?
I would hope so. Jorge and I really would like for Hanif to come in and perform with us. Hanif suffered, for your information, suffered a stroke 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been heavily in therapy. And he and I, along with other musicians, Alex Smith, Bermusudi Ali, Michael Spencer, we have been patiently, doing our due diligence to make sure that we transition him back into performing. Okay, did you get all that?
Yeah, got all that. Yeah. And so how did you get here from Georgia? Rural Georgia.
I was a member of the 6th U.S. Army Band stationed at the Presidio of San Francisco. I had one of the most charmed jobs as a trumpet player, sitting under the Golden Gate drinking coffee every morning. It was great. But, you know, the thing about this album, I guess I'm going to sway you a little bit. This is the 40th year of my son's passing.
Mm-hmm.
The album Dedications was dedicated to him. Jorge and I, we are doing what is called Dedicatorias Dos, Dedications 2.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, we are commemorating Enos Cosby, Bill Cosby's son, and my son. And this is a new version of an old hat. And this is what this is all about. It is taking one tune and transforming it into a different style of music and presenting it as sound painting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was that enough?
Yeah. That's beautiful. Jorge, why don't you talk about some of these special arrangements that you all have planned for tomorrow, and
It's exactly like Larry said. When I met him 2 years ago, I knew the kind of person and musician he was, and immediately I wanted to do something with him where we could blend the traditional jazz style with Afro-Caribbean rhythms. And it took a few months for us to actually get together, and start playing. But I heard his LP, the Dedications LP, and we had an idea. So why don't we do this in a different style? And that's how we started. He let me look at the lead charts, and I just took the melody and the theme and converted it into the arrangements that we're now going to be playing at 57th Street. And it's coming out really, really beautiful, really nice, And the ensemble is basically the piano, the bass, congas timbales, and a horn ensemble with trumpet, tenor, sax, and trombone, and of course we have the great luck that we have musicians that can double, like Larry doubling on trumpet and vibes, and Steve Marshall doubling on sax and flute and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want me to play something from Dedications 1, Larry and Jorge?
Yes, please.
Okay. Should I play the Untitled or Traces?
Play Traces first, because Traces embodies the Dedication celebration.
Okay. So we're just going to play a little bit of it, audience. Not all of it, so you have to get out to 57th Street Gallery and see what happens to this piece tomorrow.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
music.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah.
And you know what's going to happen when I conceived Dedications. I conceived Dedications as using today's technology. So on this album, it's a two-sided album. On side one, it is electric jazz, and on side two, it is acoustic jazz. But my premise is this, that I can take any one of those tunes and play them in any genre or any style that I choose. And what you're going to hear tomorrow is Traces is going to be performed in two different styles. So please, audience, if you're there, you will need to focus on the treatment that Jorge has taken the time to transform Traces into something that is very, 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 very close to my heart. Mm-hmm. Thanks, man. I really appreciate that, bro.
Oh, you're welcome. You're very welcome. I thank you, brother.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of, you know, looking at the music of the African diaspora, and of course, you know, Latin jazz is in there, and then we think about, you know, just the whole genre of improvisation and that type of music that has its roots in the African experience, you know, within this continent as well as elsewhere, and how that interplay works when you sort of interpret it in another vernacular, another voice, and how you're working that out.
Well, you know, from my perspective, like I said earlier, I looked at the pieces from scratch, and I worked off the lead chart.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed me to put in what was on my mind. You know what I mean? Rather than going with the original thought. The original, I don't want to say thought, because the thought is what got me, it inspired me. It's the theme. I'm trying to think of a word that can describe the first version.
Polyrhythmic.
And
Jorge, I'm going to jump in on this.
Yeah.
If you can give Wanda and the audience just some background of the Mozambique rhythm, the different genres of beats, of the areas of Africa, the rhythmic sounds that you are cross-pollinating into the music. Can you do
that?
Well,
you know,
because I think she would understand a lot better.
Yeah, like Mozambique, you know, it's an African. It's a root African rhythm, which, you know, was developed by Eddie Palmieri, or that's the first time that I heard that rhythm. You know, when Eddie Palmieri did Mozambique, and I heard that rhythm, and it's, you know, this is like back in the 70s is when I first heard that rhythm, and it just. You know, it's just been in the back of my mind all this time. But, yeah, you know, Puerto Rico developed that rhythm. And, you know, I'm part of the Caribbean circle. And so all that African root rhythm, polyrhythms, it's what inspires me also, you know, like Bomba from Puerto Rico. As you know, I put a little bit of that little sunflower. You know, so it's all Latin American rhythms or Caribbean rhythms are influenced by Afro roots, African roots.
Mm-hmm. And what you will be hearing, Wanda, and the audience will be a hybrid.
Yeah.
Of our interpolating the different styles and forming a sound, which I call sound painting, or SOPA. In an article in Downbeat Magazine, I introduced the concept, SOPA, sound painting. And the premise behind sound painting is that we will not be pigeonholed that we do Latin jazz or we do traditional jazz. What we are doing is painting a sound. It's a portrait of sound.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do with that, we can take, the premise is to be able to take what we do, rather than write 225 songs, I would prefer to go to 225 different countries and take these songs and perform them indigenously. You understand what
yeah.
I'm saying? And then it transforms again. Then the sound has been painted again.
Right. Yeah.
Did you get off of that, Wanda?
Right. Yeah, that sounds interesting. It's a different kind of approach to it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, I have 6 or 7 songs. Rather than writing 200 or 300 songs, I would rather go to China, Beijing, and find someone there who would like to collaborate with me, or go to Cambodia, or go to Suzhou.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's ownership in it. There's ownership in that country's vested interest. Now, in my mind, we become true ambassadors of music.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And that's
wow.
That's the idea behind sound painting or SOPA.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this
yeah.
and this was coined in almost 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I know I got you all into the studio a little bit late, but my other guest is waiting. Wanted you to give the information again about your show tomorrow for those who might have tuned in a little late. I know you're going to be at the 57th Street Gallery. If you want to give the time and the other particulars, make sure that folks who are listening can make sure they check out this wonderful concert that you have prepared for us.
Well, we will be performing at 5701 Telegraph Avenue, Oakland, California. Our start time will be 8:30 till 11, and admission is $15. And I will have several CDs for sale. And come on out and enjoy.
Okay, great. And then
yeah.
after my interview with Nora, I'm going to play the Untitled. Do you want to give us some information about that since she won't be on the air when I play it?
Now, the Untitled is the electric jazz side.
Mm-hmm.
And these songs will definitely be transformed into a different help me out, Jorge.
Again, you know, I go back to how I did it, right? You know, I got the lead sheet for my title and started from scratch. And at some point, while I was writing it, you know, while I was trying to write, I noticed that it would be that it was easy for it to write it in a 6/8 tempo with a change in meter in the middle and uno. You know, so I don't know how I came up with that, but that's how I put this together. And when you listen to the to the song that, that you'll play later, Wanda, you'll see the, I mean, you'll hear the difference out of the interpret. Well, we're not playing it, but you, if you can compare the, or if you can listen to the original version, and then try to imagine a 6/8 with a Son Montuno addition, you'll see that when we play it at 57th Street, it sounds like a totally different song. But the main theme, it's, you know, the thought behind the song is still there.
Wow. Yeah, it's going to really be an evening full of wonderful surprises for everyone. Well, thank you both
you
so much for joining us, Larry and Jorge.
Will
you see me
there?
Gosh, you know, I've got so much homework to do. I'm not sure.
Bring your homework with you, baby.
Please. Like I can do my homework sitting there. Well, we'll see what happens.
All right. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take good
care.
Thank you.
All right.
Nice to meet you.
Peace and blessings. Nice meeting you too, Jorge.
All right,
nice
to you too.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good morning, Nora. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Wow. Nora, I'm trying to figure out how to pronounce your name. Chipamari?
Chipamari.
Chipamari. You're Miriam. Wow. It is so fantastic. When I was sitting there afterwards, I'm like, how am I going to write about this? And I was asking, like, doing polls. I was saying, okay, Laura, how do I talk about this? All right, Kendra. And they would look like,
thank you. Thank you, Wanda.
Yeah, it's such a feast. I mean, it's a feast on the eyes, on the ears, you know, I mean, aesthetically and regarding all our intelligences, you hit them all. It's so beautiful.
Thank you. So stunning.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. I mean, when I read, you know, Mark Bermudi Joseph's comments, you know, as the curator, you know, director of performing arts, he says about your work, that it's gendered, muscular, political, shamanistic. It's like, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Those are all very kind and flattering things and coming from people I respect. So, you know, I'm honored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I was just thinking, I'm so happy, you know, that you're back because, you're world-renowned and you're all over the place and, you know, you used to be here a lot and, you know, you come through every now and then, but you haven't been here in a while. And so this new work, Miriam, I'm so happy that you were able to bring it for Black Choreographers Festival and to actually open the 10th anniversary with this beautiful work. It's just like setting it up at such a high note, you know?
Oh, I'm grateful. You know, the Bay Area is a second home, and the Black Choreographers Moving, you know, not only are they friends of mine, but, you know, the vision that they're proposing is just one to behold, and I'm happy to be a part of it and to open their 10 years, to celebrate their 10 years and open their next 10 years, you know. I wish them long life.
Yes. Right. Yeah, and you were born in Mutare, Zimbabwe, and you're based in New York City now, and you've been challenging and embracing stereotypes of Africa and the Black performing body, art, and aesthetic for over 10 years now. You study dance in many parts of the world, including Africa, Senegal, Burkina Faso, Kenya, Tanzania, and South Africa, Cuba, Jamaica, and the United States. You're a graduate of the University of Zimbabwe.
Not to mention Zimbabwe.
Of course.
Yeah.
And you hold an MA in dance and MFA in choreography and performance from Mills College. And you've gotten lots of awards. But I want to, like, talk a little bit about, or a lot, about Miriam and the whole idea of othering. a performer audience dilemma. And so it's like, wow. And then I was just reading, you know, your wonderful artist statement, you know, looking at light and dark, visibility and obfuscation. Is that how you pronounce it?
which word is that?
Obfuscation. Yeah, visibility and I guess what's hidden. But that's not the word
right.
you use. That's my word.
Oh, okay.
yeah, because, okay. you know, when people walk into the theater, you're there. But until our eyes adjust to the lighting, you know, you're sort of, you see this, looks like a construction site. There's the yellow
right.
tape, you know, there's the ladder, you've got hanging skulls. You know, you look closer, it's like, oh, there are bottle caps and wire and, interesting. and then
right.
there's a vessel holding water, and inside of the vessel there's a light bulb, and, you know, and then in the middle there's this big pile of, looks like, garbage bags and, you know, plastic
right.
and there's a limb sticking up. He's like, is that alive or is that a prop? You know, is that like a piece of a mannequin? And because it doesn't move,
that's
it's just
right.
it's just sitting there. It's like, and then you walk around, you know, sort of the taped area, and you see these rocks, which remind me of Zimbabwe. Actually, I was in Zimbabwe and Harare and Chimanimani and Amatoko.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, I was there last summer in August.
Beautiful. So you know
yeah.
what the rocks are all about.
yeah, I was totally feeling it. Mm-hmm. And then walking around, I was like, so she brought the rocks in. Cool. Yes. So talk about this work, and then, you know, Omar, like, oh my God, the score. I'm like, and then there's Tex, and then this beautiful woman, you know, this other character, and like, who is she with the cigarette?
Oakley, Okafor Philly. Yes. Well, there's a lot to talk about, but I'm so grateful that you started with that environment that you walk into, you know, that mm-hmm. that universe, that space. So what is that space? Some people have described it as Afrofuturistic, which I really love, you know, because I'm also after Sun Ra, so, you know,
mm-hmm.
thinking. But, you know, that it is a construction site, and I love that word construction because we do construct, you know, our memories, we construct our identities, we construct our genders, we construct everything about ourselves, and then we try to just hold up that construction. So it is both a construction site in the sense that we are kind of constructing something. You know, the piece is alive. We are making it in the moment as well. I mean, of course, it has been pre-organized, but for me, live performance is in the moment. We have to adjust to this moment we're in and construct it and respond appropriately, not just this is what we did last week or the year before. It's, this is the moment we're in, so let's construct this moment appropriately. So it is also a crime scene, I think. You know, the caution tape, you know, sort of suggests both that an area where there's danger, and it could be a place where something is being built and you need a hard hat, you know. So in some ways, I'm also inviting the audience to put on their hard hats, to put on their armor and to engage, you know, with this work without, you know, backing out. It is could also be a crime scene, you know, where the police have taped off, you know, an area that needs to be investigated. So I really love both ways of thinking about this set that you walk in. For me, it is recalling home in the sense of the stones. Stones appear again and again in my work because Zimbabwe is a house of stone. And it's my way to always acknowledge where I'm from, you know, and be remind people to stay aware of that reality too. The debris, the what looks like a pile of garbage, that in many you know, African communities or even in the African diaspora. We do have to be creative about the
the junk, so the recycling, whatever. We, I think, have always been recycling before this term came into being. And I know that, you know, from where I come from, in Zimbabwe, the ability to take wire and build something beautiful out of it, you know, the ability to take things that were about to be thrown off and repurpose them for something that becomes a work of art. So in a way, the set, the destruction site, this crime scene has to do also about beauty and ability to take something and reshape it. Yeah, the obstructed view that the caution tapes also represents. I mean, I've been very much in love with Fred Morton and the way that he is talking about what we want to reveal and what we don't want to reveal. So this idea of creating some sort of obstruction, you know, some things you're allowed to see, some things you're not allowed to see, but you also have, as an audience, a choice in where you sit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know,
yeah.
Sometimes, you know, and so all of that creates, I think, a world that to me is you have to be constantly shifting with it and surrendering. You know, some of the things that you come into the space with that, you know, it's not your typical dance performance. It's not your typical theater performance. You know, it's something that is alive, you know, and what does it mean to be presenting something that is alive, what and all, you know? Yeah, I don't think it's a perfect universe that I've created, but I think life is not perfect.
Yeah, yeah. As you were speaking, I was just thinking of some questions I was having as I was watching it yesterday, and I was like, or last night, I should say. And the idea, yeah, Afrofuturistic, yeah, Sun Ra. We were just speaking of him with my my last two guests, and I was thinking about as I was watching the interaction between you and the other character, who is she reminds me. At first, you just hear the boots coming in, and I'm wondering, like, okay, well, it can't be, you know, the Nora character because there are no boots there, and because, you know, as we're watching, the lights go up and down, and so you can't see, you don't know where, like, the sound is coming from the doorway, which might be really far from you depending on where you're sitting, and I had to keep on looking, like to see if that was there, like, an embodiment of the sound, or was that coming from the speakers, because you don't know whether or not it's in the room, you know, like, in flesh, or if it's in the room in spirit. I mean, that is so well done, Nora. Oh, my goodness. That is awesome.
Thank you. And
I mean, your sound design is just fantastic.
Well, the sound designer and the composer, you know, I mean, I think I worked in collaboration with Omar Sosa, who, of course, is just a brilliant mind and a fearless collaborator, and I mean that as the highest praise when you're working with somebody who is able to check their ego, but at the same time to be secure enough to be shifted out of their position. You know, Omar Sosa was very much intrigued by the process, you know, of building a dance, of writing the script, because as a choreographer, really, essentially what I'm doing is writing the script. You know, it doesn't exist until I've written it. And Omar, in his improvisation world, they come in and the performance is the script. You know, so, you know, the taking time and months, I think we build it over a series of months to, okay, let's look at what we have in the space and let's work with the things that we have in the space first and then build it from there. So he was so accommodating and so very much thrilled to figure out how to work with the water drip, how to work with the rocks, how can we embed the sound of the rocks rolling, you know, so that at times we feel like the boots that we're wearing, which are wooden shoes, you know, and the rocks rolling. And what about the plastic? How does it become part of the score? So we build the score really from what was in the space, including our human voices. You know, there's one section where it's very boot-driven, the South African boot dance-driven, and it was Oma, myself, and Okwi, you know, stomping away in a studio. You know, and recording that. And every breath I took, there's also just a very subtle wave of breathing in and out all throughout
yes.
the soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is me breathing as I am moving, and so we're recording all of that. And then the genius of Oma is then to take all that material and weave it in, you know, and then write this brilliant sound score, you know, from the elements that were in the space, as opposed to, you know, I have recorded bazillion albums, now use my music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that kind of way, and Oma was gracious enough to not insist on this is what I've done. You know, many dancers just take recorded music, or if they love a composer or musician, they just work with what exists of theirs. But, you know, this was an interesting departure for Oma. And out of this, I think he created another album, really, another CD. So the score is a character. Just as you say, you know, you're not sure whether it's coming from the person or is coming out of the speakers. We really wanted to have this feeling of this moving sound. You know, and we really were only limited by budget in the end, you know, that we didn't, you know, we wanted to really confuse people in the way that I think if you are in rituals, you know, real rituals, you know, you lose the sense of where things are and where they're coming from. We wanted to also imbue the space with that sensibility.
Mm-hmm. I'm so happy you mentioned ritual, because when I walked into the space, I saw the altar because I saw the skulls, you know, and, you know,
right.
immediately as, like, I started thinking about the Egun. And you know, the middle could be like a burial space. I mean, that could be earth, you know.
Right. Right.
And
exactly.
Yeah, the leg could be, you know, a marker, you know,
it's,
on the grave.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
absolutely.
Yeah, because,
all
you know.
Those readings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Wanda.
No, I was just going to mention, you know, your work. You know, you've done a whole lot of work around, you know, how does a nation heal from, you know, the trauma of, you know, colonization and the war, you know, that just really ripped asunder, you know, so many great monuments. You think about the Great Zimbabwe and you know, and Cecil Rhodes and you know, and the destruction of Cecil Rhodes, you know, across the landscape. You know, but Zimbabwe, you know, is free, you know, but the liberation came
right.
at a cost, and you've you know, done work around that. So, you know,
yes.
when one knows a little bit of your body of work, you know, you see some of those things, elements.
Right,
you know,
right.
In the current
right.
work. Mm-hmm.
Oh, say thank you, because I think, yeah, well, you know, I am who I am. I'm a person of my time, so my body is mocked. By all that history that you have spoken for, but I'm also interested, you know, in what is the future, you know, how, you know, I'm also interested in the future and that place of the avant-garde, and not just being limited by this sort of perception of Africa and all the arts of Africa as holders of the past. You know, that we are also holders of the future. So in creating this sort of Afrofuturistic space, you know, I'm also aware that I am driven by this desire to not just be kowtowing to this legacy, this brilliant legacy of Africa's past, but that we can create work that pushes the boundaries, you know, towards our future. And so that's, I think Miriam is really a stunning visual piece as well. It's an installation.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And that, you know, I mean, I wish some museum would just take the whole piece and just, you know, put it up there and leave it there, because there's so much to digest. And we try to encourage at the end, we put all the lights up so that people can actually walk through, you know, the space and really look at how the materials are constructed and put together. You know, the lights that come up at the end is an invitation for the audience to engage with the space. And in a way, it's also a bow for the audience, because we don't make the traditional bows, but that the audience salutes itself for its own courage to, you know, travel with this piece.
You know, I'm thinking that perhaps you're one that needs to tell the ushers, because there were not many of us that wanted to engage the installation, and then we were rushed and told to leave. So, yeah, because the lights didn't come up quickly.
Oh, that's unfortunate,
I think. Yeah, yeah, and yeah. I thought, I mean, you know how we're really well trained in America. You know, the lights come up, you leave. You know, you wait for the person to come back out for the bow. It's like, oh, they're not coming back out. Hmm, I wonder what that means. and then you exit.
Yeah.
You don't go look closer, because that's not necessarily encouraged in American theater etiquette. So I think the ushers need to be told to encourage the audience to look at it before they exit, not rush
out. I would do a better job of, you know, putting that word out, because, you know, that's why the lights, you know, because we could easily stay in the black, you know, and then just the house lights come up. But there's just this beautiful lane that, you know, comes up, and then it was just really our creative way to say, okay, now the space is open. And in different parts of the world where we've shown this work, you know, some people are always keen to get close up and personal with the object, and that has happened. But perhaps you're right. Perhaps it's also worthwhile to just have people know that is, you know, that is allowed. You're permitted. You know, most museums don't allow you to get up. You know, like they put a little barrier and they say, you know, do not cross the line. You know, they put wires. They put all kinds of little markers that say you cannot cross. But, you know, even though we have the, you know, the caution tape on different fronts, there are some fronts that are open too. So there is an opening and a closure, and but perhaps, you know, more can be done to encourage people to really look at you know, everything is made by hand essentially in that space, and you know, I think I want to share the evidence of that hand in the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really, you know, the intricacies of the pieces, you know, you've got the jawbone of bovine, you know, hanging, and then you've got the skulls, and it's really, you know, the intricacy of that work, you know, on those pieces is really, you know, like, I kept on looking at that, but then, like I said, we were rushed. Like, oh, okay, you need to leave. It's like, oh, shoot. Yeah, so anyway, but yeah, I mean, I went and looked anyway. I mean, I wasn't invited. I didn't know I
good
could, but I said I needed to understand in with the full light, sort of, you know,
exactly.
what you
think,
have.
I think in general, audiences need to be more proactive anyway, and part of the, you know, I mean that in the best way, that, you know, we are all citizens of the world. I am a citizen of the world. I, you know, I am trying to, you know, bend the rules to meet my imagination as much as possible, you know, in a union house, in a, you know, sort of a proscenium, you know, so all these things we have to work around. You know, what the rules are, you know, for the betterment of our humanity, essentially. But if we're always kowtowing to the rules, I think art would, you know, basically be useless if it was just, you know, following the rules. And I think audience members, yes, it's nice that they're so well behaved, but I do think sometimes it's to our detriment. I mean, the thing that I love about performing in places like, you know, Africa is that you get immediate response. Either people will walk onto your stage and show you how to do the movement better, or they will speak to you, you know, in encouragement or in determined, you know, that you get a very visceral relationship. You have a very visceral and kinesthetic relationship with the audience, that the people know it is their right, you know, to share this artistic moment with you, you know.
Right. Oh, that's really wonderful. Do you have, like, another couple of minutes?
Yes, I do.
Oh, super. Yeah, I was really sort of noticing, you know, the different, you know, sort of intentional sort of physical elevations. You know, we've got the ladder, and then we've got Okwewi. How do you pronounce her name? Okwewi's character, you know, who is higher, you know, than your character. I mean, literally, she's
right,
sitting on top of the ladder, and then you know, she has on the wooden shoes, so she's physically taller when she's not on the ladder. But when she came in, I thought of her as more like an angel, because she has wings on her, or what could be interpreted as wings. I think she's like an ancestor or a good spirit that's kind of mischievous, because there's a lot of laughter in the piece as well. You know, your character laughs and her character laughs, and sometimes the laughter is like, you know, you're going along a little bit too long here. Like, it's not funny anymore, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, and the interplay of the two characters. And then I also noticed, I was thinking, I didn't understand all of the dialogue, and I was wishing, like, oh, I wish I could read it, because I really liked what I was getting, but I didn't have a narrative sense of like the whole breadth of the interaction. But but it sounded like, it reminded me of auctioning, you know, and the black
right.
body being exploited, and particularly
right.
when, you know, your character had to turn around and she had to do these repetitive motions, which reminded me of, you know, like showing off this and showing off that for the potential buyer. And I was reminded
right.
also of Hottentot Venus, because she's, you know, a Southern African woman who was exploited in Europe. And then now has, you know, returned home, you know, to South Africa and had a proper burial so that her spirit can finally rest. So I just wanted you to talk about that a little bit. And then my last question had to do with the whole title, Miriam.
Well, let's start with Miriam, because perhaps you will answer, you know, the two characters. The piece is inspired by, you know, the legendary Miriam Makeba, also may her soul rest in peace, you know, who I just felt is an icon for me, and perhaps for many, many people of a certain generation, perhaps. But for most of us of that short century, of that liberation struggle, you know, era, Miriam Makeba is definitely an icon, you know, for me as a woman artist first, as well as a political activist, you know, as an African woman. I can only imagine just how much courage it took to break away from, you know, almost the script of what it is to be an African girl growing up in an African family. You know, the expectations that she completely rewrote that script, you know, and became this famous, you know, artist with very little, I would say, of the formal education that perhaps allows women of the feminist movement in the West to get, you know, to break the glass ceiling. so to speak. So Mary McKebber is very important to me, as are the other Marys that are iconic, you know, the Virgin Mary, the sister of Moses. You know, women who I think that this triage, the three women, to me propose a certain beauty, a certain courage, a certain way to accept burden, and rise above it, you know. So there's a real question about, you know, how femininity, how it's portrayed, how it's embraced. And there's not one way to approach it. So I thought this idea of the icon, of this female icon, of this beautiful virginal, you know, and I sort of think of Miriam McKebber's voice as even almost virginal, as the image of the Virgin Mary is forever, you know, pure. You know, the way she would speak, Miriam McKebber, that is, so sweetly, and smile. There's just something so chaste, pure. You know, and the sister of Moses, how she was this warrior who used music and dance to lead people, you know, to war, but through an art form, you know, through this way of celebrating the body. I felt like I couldn't in my body carry the breadth, the depth of this icon. So I had to split it into two parts. One who seems angelic, and you're right to think of a queer as an angel, as an ancestor, as this otherworldly creature, you know, who comes in, and is she a direct reflection of, is she just another facet of who I am? And then there's this other dark side, you know, who I embody, who is born into her burden. So we thought of that first image as, if you think about the Venus, the Botticelli Venus, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
This iconic, classic image of this blonde woman who's born out of the sea, out of, you know, out of air, you know, to this extreme, excruciating beauty, you know. So my question was, if you were to define an African woman, you know, if that's the image that the West holds as beauty of this Venus, you know, the Botticelli, so the African Venus, for me, the African woman is coming into the world already burdened, you know, and she has to carry her burdens with grace. You know, there is the expectation from the family, there is expectation from the community, from the nation, from, you think about all the whole breadth of it, and I'm talking specifically as an African woman, you know, who comes from a family that is conservative, that is traditional, and has this prescription for women becoming the caregiver, you know, the wife, the mother, that script.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so for me, the image of an African woman is this woman with all her weight, but she has to hold it with grace. You see all these beautiful pictures of African women with the things on their heads, and they're tall, they're graceful, they move with such elegance, and yet the truth is those things are heavy,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they carry with such elegance. So I was keen to explore this heaviness, this darkness, literally and metaphorically, but also for these women, my Marys, you know, that of course, clearly, who asked the Virgin Mary to, you know, to become the mother of Jesus, you know, she probably wasn't ready for it, you know, and wasn't the sister of Moses rather annoyed that it was her brother who ran off with the fame and not her. And you know, and clearly there was a dark side to Miriam McKebber. She wandered 30 years in the world in exile, and that's in our time now, that's a biblical proportion exile, you know. So, you know, so these two characters are both going in light and dark, exploring light and dark, but clearly not one person is ever dark and not one person is ever light. You know, so, you know, they are sort of nuances where, you know, she starts to withhold or play with the power. She's high up there, and yet she has the power to deny or to give, you know. And then what happens when she comes down, you know, all these sort of nuances with the two characters. I see them as one person. They're really one person, but, you know, they're exploring different facets of this one person, of this Miriam.
Yeah, so you've externalized what's often termed as a split that we have as people in the African diaspora, you know, sort of those of us, or even those of us that haven't necessarily experienced colonialization or enslavement, you know, that trauma, you know, shows up in our persons, you know, in our psyche as a split. So you've actually externalized the split in your two characters, so to speak.
Right.
And sometimes the split is seen as a light and a dark because there is that tension, you know, between who I am and who I have to appear to be, you know.
Right.
And yeah.
Right, but good and bad is it's rather the simplest way we can define it, good and bad. But also I was going to say that I think it's more nuanced than just good and bad. You know, we're all
Certainly.
Good and we're all bad at the same time.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Uh-huh. And then there's also just this thing. I'll just say one last thing. I know we've gone over our time,
okay.
But there's this attempt to grapple with you know, Joseph Conrad and the Heart of Darkness. You know, the text that is coming back again and again is really born, it's extracted from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, who, you know, was a Polish man, a writer using English, which wasn't his first language. So I was also interested in what that is, you know, for an artist who was living, you know, in another place. So this idea of othering, like I am always an other. I think artists are always others, you know, and our ability to, you know, to shed light on something. Joseph Conrad was really able to illuminate the imperialistic project,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I find his text to be very, very revealing of the thinking around, you know, Africa as the place of darkness. And in my iteration of this construction site, this crime scene is also woman as the heart of darkness, as the darkness, as the unknown.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and so darkness is the enigma, but it's not a place to be afraid of. It's just a place to know that you don't know. And it's
right.
a place of, you know, sort of, you know, many secrets and you know, and you know, such richness. You think about dark earth, you know, that's the kind of earth you
right.
want.
Of course. That's
yeah.
that's most fertile.
mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
Right.
Wow. Oh, this is so rich. So I was wondering, Do you ever publish? I mean, like, you've done other work. I was looking in your statement about your work with Thomas Mafumo and the Blacks
right.
Unlimited, and I like the title, mm-hmm. Lions Will Roar, Swans Will Fly, Angels Will Wrestle Heaven, Rains Will Break.
Rains Will Fall.
Yeah, and that's so the title is so beautiful. Like, have you ever
Thank
published
you.
Any of the text for your works, or is there a place where we can go and read, you know, sort of the text for this particular work, Miriam? For those that are
well,
interested,
I have to say I am really, really I'm married to the written word and also to English being, you know, sort of a war trophy and a continued, you know. Way to deal with the world through a language that isn't really mine, you know. So I write a lot, you know. The work is always scripted, and I am, you know, I'm getting to a point where you know, archiving and gathering the body of work, you know, because I've been like so busy making it and not realizing that I've actually been creating a body of work. That all of it, if you even go back to the work I was doing while I was in the Bay Area, Wow. You know, there was always text, mm-hmm. you know, and it was it has to do with my desire to understand what this word is. So I've been, gathering a lot of work that is driven by my need to understand word, to understand English. And even my most current work, because Miriam really was premiered in 2012 and it's had a beautifully long life, but my most current work, The Right Riot, which is sort of a twisted response to Stravinsky and Nijinsky, is describing my black African body. And there's a whole text. I've actually written a whole manifesto and got, you know, a fellow artist, James Hanahine, to also write a script, and also Teju Cole to write a script in response to my script, to James Hanahine's script. So I'm really, it's a beautiful question. Thank you. I'm gathering, you know, all these materials that I do eventually want to have, you know, in a book, you know, called like Nora Chibamir, Cool, Bad, and Ugly.
Yeah. Wow. I'm looking forward to that. That'll be really awesome. Yeah. Hopefully I know you're constantly creating, but hopefully you'll have some time to devote to that task or give it to someone. Because all you need to do is just give them the material and they could pull it together for you.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us more about Okwi. Tell us more about her and your relationship.
Yes, Okwi Okwuapesili is born and raised in the Bronx, New York. She's a New Yorker. Of Nigerian parentage. So she's an actor of and a performer of massive reputation of her own work too. She has done a great deal of work with Ralph Lemon in his trilogies and continues to be, a muse. I would call her a muse for Ralph Lemon, the African-American choreographer. She is also makes her own work, which is phenomenal, sort of in this in-between crack of, is it theater, is it dance, but who cares? It's alive and it's beautiful. And really embodying these interesting spaces of, she is an African born in America to these African parents, and she has to negotiate what that means. So I feel that in her body, this duality, this tension, this questioning is so very present, you know, as is extreme heightened skill as an actor, as just a present person in the space. I would say, she would say she's a mover and not a dancer, because she's trained as an actor. I just feel extremely blessed that I have this ability right now to be working with an artist who has Africa in close proximity and has extreme questions about what it means to be an African woman now, you know, and how do we define that. I think her presence and her questioning has helped me sort of expand my idea of, you know, Africa is an idea. You know, so when we all say, oh, we can't talk about Africa because it's not just a country, it's this continent, but I'm talking about Africa as an idea. It's only an idea beyond its geography as a continent. And so I feel that with Okwi, we have this possibility nightly to question this idea and to construct this idea of what Africa is. you know.
Yes, certainly.
And how
yeah.
that manifests in our body. I can't sing her praises more than that. But she, like Omar Sosa, one of the most generous, you know, artists that I have worked with, and that she, you know, she surrenders to this moment. And you know, we just go together. We travel together. You know.
Mhm. Yeah.
I can't say any more other than she's just you know, she's just beautiful. She's mm-hmm. absolutely beautiful, and a sister, a friend, and an artist beyond measure. And I hope that she will be able to be seen more in her own work, which, you know, people on the East Coast see her a great deal in her own work, which is phenomenal.
Mhm. Yeah. That is really great, you know, as a choreographer, to be able to have this vision, and then, you know, to be able to pull all these collaborators together to help you realize, you know, what you have in your head, and you know, what you have embodied.
Right.
You know, a lot of times
right.
we
no,
have
I
ideas.
Mean, I think
mm-hmm.
I'm
yeah.
absolutely. I'm primarily a solo artist, and I think I'll always be, because that's how my heart really is. So set on, you know, the solitude of, you know, working and, you know, building the thing. It has to be born out of my own physical body. And then other people, there are other people who have greater skills in terms of light, in terms of sound, you know, that then come in to help shape this thing. So the act of collaboration to me is extremely difficult, but also so life-giving, in that when it does work, you know, something like Miriam happens. You know,
right.
when,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are many instances where collaborations aren't so don't work so well. But I'm also interested in investigating this idea of what happens, you know, when I break out of my solitude and meet another person who's equally skilled and determined, you know, to express themselves, you know, this dying and being born again, you know, that happens in a collaboration is something that I'm committed to. Like, I will never have a company, because I'm not interested in being, you know, the godhead of, you know, some groupies who want to do my movement and do that. I think in this collaborative process, I'm meeting people who are as convinced about themselves and their place in the world, and that, you know, we both have to give something to create, you know, to come to this this idea that I've sort of dreamt of, and like, okay, let's build it. I think it's a wonderful and complicated process. You know, that I'm very much dedicated to, as I am dedicated to this question of what is Africa? What is this idea of Africa? You know, what is this idea of this Afrofuturism stuff? What are these gendered spaces that we, you know, we can build? What does it mean to really collaborate? Can we really collaborate? What does it take to collaborate? You know, and I think as I'm growing older and I'm a little bit more patient, you know, and drawing people towards my sphere who are just, you know, brilliant, you know, I hope I continue to be able to afford these kind of collaborations, because they're not cheap.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm so happy that you're able to, you know, have the resources, you know, monetary resources to be able to bring this work alive.
Absolutely. I can't downplay that. I mean, Miriam is I mean, it took a great deal of, you know, monetary resources. you know, and we're not even talking about the other resources that are extremely important, which are psychic, emotional, time, you know, and those the artists have in abundance. What we don't have is the money
right.
to build the work that we really want to build. And, you know, I do believe that all of us, if we were able to have, if money wasn't a problem, I don't know what we would make, really, because the sky would be the limit. You know, we're only limited by, you know, well, how am I going to pay these people now?
Right, yeah. I was thinking as you were talking, sort of talking about your process, you know, your it sounds like your body is your easel, you know, and your choreography is like the pen and or the brush. Yeah, wow. Want to let our audience know that Nora, pronounce your last name for us again, Nora.
Chipaumire.
Chipaumire. Chipaumire.
Chipaumire. It's really, it's Shona, but the best way to think about it is vowel sounds and the way you'd pronounce Spanish in a way, you know,
okay.
Chipaumire.
Oh, Chipaumire.
Umire, yes, exactly.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, I just have to say it a little slower. Chipaumire.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right,
yeah.
Wanda. It's
okay.
Beautiful.
Well, your Miriam is up, you know, Thursday through Saturday. Oh, there's no Sunday. 8 p.m. at Yerba Buena Forum, 701 Mission Street in San Francisco. And I was wondering, I think there's an audience talk back. Is it tonight or is it tomorrow or did I misread that?
There's an audience talk back tonight.
Oh, how lucky for those people. Nice.
Come back, Wanda.
Oh, I might have to, yeah, because that's at 9 p.m. because it's just an hour long. Oh, I am totally coming back.
Right.
I'll be in San Francisco. Oh, awesome.
Oh,
that's going to be so great. Wow. So people can, like, you're going to lift the light so people can see, and you can tell them, go ahead, people, walk
exactly.
around.
Exactly. And do come back, and thank you for having me on your wonderful program, and it's nice to catch up with you again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking forward to at least saying, hey, Nora, it's been like years. But, yeah, I'll totally come back tonight for your talk back so I can see you, and thank you for this wonderful work, Miriam. And, for your continued creativity, because you're telling those stories that, you know, that we all embody, particularly, you know, sort of women of African descent, women who are conscious. And then, you know, for you to be in this weekend, you know, where there's Valentine's Day, which is today, and that's the
Yay.
Day when, you know, we're looking at the 1 billion rising and sort of stopping the violence against women and girls worldwide. I mean, it's just like a – and then, you know, sort of the otherness and, what, you know, who is more other than women, right?
Right.
In a patriarchal, you know, world society mindset, it's just perfect, you know, philosophically for you to be doing Miriam right now.
Thank
so
you.
It's just great, really great. Yeah,
and
thank
happy
you so
Valentine's.
Much. Happy Valentine's to you too, and look forward to seeing you this evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Wanda.
Oh, you're
okay,
welcome.
Bye-bye.
Peace and blessings. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. So we're going to close with this piece, Untitled, that you'll be able to hear tomorrow, reinterpreted in the Larry Douglas and Jorge Pinata's concert at 57th Street Gallery. That's February 15th. I think the concert starts at 8:30, and the doors open a little bit earlier, and it's going to be a really wonderful evening, so you need to tell everybody so they can get out and you know, sort of participate in this wonderful evening of music. Peace and blessings. thanks so much for tuning in to Wanda's Picks this Friday, February 14th, 2014. Tune in for another edition of Wanda's Picks at 7 a.m. on Wednesday. What is Wednesday's date? Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Note the new time. Peace and blessings.